Welcome to the CIO Evolution. In this podcast, we'll explore the Chief Information Officer's role in executing a new ongoing leadership imperative, digital transformation that promotes agility and resilience. How do CIOs upgrade legacy networks? What are the financial challenges CIOs face? And what are the security measures that are required in the new work from anywhere, mobile and cloud-based world?
Welcome to the CIO Evolution. This is Chris Jablonski, Director of CXO Revolutionaries and Community at Zscaler. Cybercrime at the state, local, and education level hits hard and in a different way than in the corporate sphere. And it's getting worse. A recent report from the Center for Internet Security documented a 148% increase in malware attacks and a more than 50% increase in ransomware incidents from 2022 to 2023 in this relatively digitally sluggish part of the public sector. CXO Revolutionaries recently held a virtual event for the public sector with Kavita Mariapan, Executive Vice President, Customer Experience and Transformation, moderating. We invited CXOs from the states of Oklahoma, Wisconsin, and Arizona for a status check on IT and cyber. They covered the challenges technology leaders face in maturing their organization's security infrastructure and the resources they have to work with. By listening to this episode, you will better understand the interconnectedness of federal, state, and local levels and the role of trust in whole of state and the importance of State Ramp, public-private sector collaboration program to help state and local governments enhance their cybersecurity and manage third-party risk. Thank you for tuning in, and please subscribe to this podcast if you haven't already done so. Now on with the program.
Michael, I'll start with you. If you would like to give us a 30,000 foot view on the IT challenges of the state of that the state of Oklahoma is really facing today, let's kind of delve into that a little bit.
Certainly, I mean it's. I doubt this is going to be a unique story to anybody. In my area specifically, where we're looking at cybersecurity, the attacks keep coming. They become more numerous. They become more sophisticated every day, and the challenge of meeting those threats and dealing with them before they cause loss to citizens is, it's not getting easier. That's the only thing I can say about it. I would say it's probably the scope of government too that makes it even more challenging. Not only do you have health information, but there's criminal justice information, there's Department of Transportation, all these other, like you said earlier, citizen services that we generally don't think twice about until we need them. All of those fall into our specific areas of concern, and staying on top of all of it is it's a massive challenge. It requires a dedicated team that's always on point.
Hats off to the three of you for kind of navigating this journey. As we all know, it's kind of an ongoing journey, right? The threats keep coming. Legislation and regulations continue to evolve, and technology keeps evolving, and you've got this critical responsibility of keeping critical services up and running, as well as keeping everybody safe, right? And the state's economy pumping. So it's a lot of priorities a lot of important vital things that you have responsibilities for. JR, I wanted to kind of pivot to you just for a moment. We've seen state government, local government, and the education sector being very successfully targeted by ransomware over the last couple of years. I hope you've seen it. And to what extent are states prepared for these kind of onslaught of threats? And specifically, what risks and threats are you in your role as the CIO of the state and from your vantage point at State Ramp, what are you concerned about most?
So I'll split my answer into two parts. One, One, as a CIO for the state of Arizona, if I have to pick, you know, if I can only pick one threat, because frankly, as Michael indicated, like it's all the threats, right? All the threats are real. But the one that I probably, if it was going to keep me up at night, is going to be, our own people, right? Which are, they're our greatest defense and they're our greatest vulnerability. And so we seek to invest in education and training and, awareness among our people to really enlist them as part of our cybersecurity workforce, because they are the ones that are going to be faced with all the phishing emails and the various things that they can click on that will, you know, punch a hole through everything else that we're doing. But then we seek to, you know, like I guess any good cybersecurity professional would tell you, layers and layers and layers. So we have, various tools and technologies that we put in place to help support and to augment and to, you know, catch things, prevent as much as we can from getting through to the end users, and then helping them make good choices once things are presented to them. So as a CIO, that's how I would answer that question. In my role from a StateRAMP perspective, that is really around when we talk about, cloud service providers and SaaS solutions and working in the cloud, it's how do we protect, all the state data, and or government data that's going into those environments and ensure that it is getting the same stewardship that it would receive, if it was sitting, quote, in front of me. To understand that there's shared responsibility when we engage, these third party providers. And so the objective of StateRAMP is to seek to mitigate those risks, to provide not only assessment, but continuous monitoring that helps ensure that those partners that anyone engages with that has gone through either the ready or the authorization process has good security controls in place and good practices that are upholding the protection of the data.
No, it's wonderful to see that. And I personally, I'm so grateful for the initiative. I mean, so much focus, and rightfully so, on the federal side of the house, right, and FedRAMP. But I think we sometimes overlook, the number of states that we have that are all operating, as individual entities and yet harmonizing across what needs to be harmonized, as well as, aligning with kind of a lot of the federal requirements. It's a pretty broad scope, and a lot of very localized needs as well, right? And so I'm so glad to see the momentum and the traction that StateRAMP's taking with the work that with under your leadership as well. I wanted to also call out, we have people here today who have dialed in, obviously joined us from South Africa. We've got people from Portland, Ohio, Washington. So it's great to see people kind of reaching out from far and wide. So Jerry, you kind of set us up for my question for David. You talked a lot about kind of the increasing threats and the need for, obviously citizen awareness around, basic cybersecurity hygiene, right? As well as, you touched upon kind of jobs. So David, I wanted to kind of point this question at you in terms of what pointed out. You've seen in your role as well, increasing technical complexity. You've got rising costs, obviously, with everything that needs to be done for mitigating risk, and clearly a shortage of skilled labor in this space, both IT modernization, IT, as well as cybersecurity. Is it realistic to expect, state and local governments to be able to effectively deliver IT services to citizens while keeping the network secure? Obviously, it's... we have work to do, but I wanted to point kind of that direct question, share with us those challenges, from this angle.
Yes, Kavita, thanks for the question. Let me start with what JR was talking about, our first line of defense and trying to prevent. We don't have to address these incidences if we can prevent them. But the realistic part of this is that they're going to occur. And if we can educate and build awareness of the people on the keyboard navigating the internet and being subject to these attacks, they're in. And now that they're in, we've got to respond. And everyone on this call knows there's a tremendous dearth of cyber professionals. We don't have enough people. We didn't have them yesterday. We're not going to have them tomorrow. Let me applaud Kavita's efforts here in Women's History Month and the International Women's Day. We need more women in the cyber workforce. And if we need more people, half of that staffing should be made up of women. And if we have more women involved, that will chip away at our need for cyber professionals. I think they're an excellent personality for this job. I think they can really do a great job in terms of assisting us in staffing an incident response team. I was fortunate in Wisconsin that of all the incidences that we had one at a time. What happens if we have multiples? That's when it gets really difficult. If some of you might remember, a few years ago, Texas got hit with more than 20 simultaneously, all sourced from an MSP. But regardless of where it's sourced from, they had to, that really diluted and made it difficult for the response teams to attack 20 different locations at the same time. So while we think we're comfortable in being able to meet an incident one-off and that they occur once a month, you're deluding yourself. I think what's going to happen in the future is that they're going to increase in complexity. With fake news and AI, they're going to look more real. And I think we need to make sure that we're doing all we can, K through 12, higher ed, two-year certificates, just to be able to get enough people on staff to be able to do this. This is in the federal government, in state and local government. So I'll leave it with this. Once the incident occurs, it has to be a collaborative effort. And Jen Esterly at CISA has created the JCDC, the Joint Cyber Defense Collaborative. That's what we need to work on. And working with State Ramp is also another opportunity to be comfortable with our partners and making sure that we can align up the appropriate level of staffing to respond to the incidents. Back to you, Kavita.
No, thanks for that, David, and thank you for the shout out. I appreciate it. I also appreciate a lot of the partnership and the allyship over the years. I think, you know, that's what we need. And as we talk about embracing diverse talent, I think it also extends beyond just women to other minority groups. And that, you know, the only way we're gonna solve a lot of this is to embrace, you know, the broad talent pool that we have and reach deep, right? And allyship, obviously, over the years. I wanted to move our conversation from talking about problems. You know, I always tell my team, don't come to me with problems, come to me with solutions. So let's talk about strategies for solving these challenges that we've addressed. I think one of the strategies that many in the audience may be aware of is the state approach. So Gerald, might start with you. State governments oversee various entities with, you know, different cybersecurity needs. Budgets, infrastructures, and then unifying these disparate entities is where a whole of state approach usually comes into play. Are you able to elaborate kind of what this whole of state approach really is in practice?
So I'll say, as we've talked about it and thought about it and how we're kind of rolling with it in Arizona, I'll say it starts with the recognition that, you know, all of us as government entities, we are all interconnected. We are part of a larger ecosystem. You know, there are very real interconnections between us. There's very real dependencies that we have with one another. And to think that, okay, well, if I'm at the state level and I'm protecting my executive branch agencies, like that's good enough, because the fact is that, you know, we interact with the cities and the counties and the municipalities, and frankly, a bad day for them is a bad day for all of us. So that's our starting point. Then as we seek to engage with them, the approach that we've taken in Arizona is to take the very same contracts, products, and partners that we're working with, and to seek to extend those, you know, out to the whole of state approach. So we're offering, you know, tools and best practices and standard work, and it's extremely helpful. You know, as we get into, I'll say, kind of the medium to small, those that don't, not only are they understaffed, but the staff that they have it's their IT person and their cybersecurity person, and who knows what else that they're doing, right? And so because their time is limited and their funding is limited, for us to be able to bring not only tools that are paid for, but then practices that come along with it to help them be successful with it, you know, that's been key to the overall effort. And really creating that community, creating a community that is where we seek to create trust, to ensure that, hey, there's not shame if it's a bad day. Like, we're in this with you. And as you know, I think as David indicated, it's really about responding and recovering and coming alongside. And so that, I think, has really helped progress the whole state approach in Arizona, and our cyber team within the Department of Homeland Security here in Arizona is really leading the charge on that and doing a wonderful job.
Excellent. So I think from you know, if I had to kind of extrapolate, you know, what you're saying is the efforts are being made around, you know, definition of policy, enforcement of policy, and harmonization across kind of solutions and technologies deployed, so that there is some sort of a unified strategy and policy in terms of how, you know, you're all tackling this from a state and local government perspective, right? Some level of standardization as well. And obviously education across the board to bring, you know, bring everybody along for that journey. Michael, kind of building on what JR just said, are there any real world examples among kind of state and local government collaboration in the state of Oklahoma that you've specifically been involved with or have kind of spearheaded?
There are a few, actually. So from a preparation standpoint, the National Guard here actually conducts an exercise every year. It's a two-week thing, a week of training and a week of exercise, where you've got the National Guard, you've got some federal agencies, you've got state, you've got even some private partners that all come together. And one of the things that really does, to JR's point earlier, is it gives people a chance to work together without without our hair on fire. It's a chance to practice before we have to do the real thing. Beyond that, in the more preparation space, you've got obviously the state and local cybersecurity grant program. We are using a lot of the same tactics that Mr. Sloan mentioned, trying to get the same pricing out to smaller entities that can't buy in quantities of tens of thousands. We're doing all those things, and we're trying to encourage those that might need a little help affording the best of breed tools of the trade today to use those funds, to apply for them, use them. And if they use those funds, oh, by the way, Oklahoma Cyber Command is using them too. So if they have that bad day, there's not as much learning curve. Our people can step in and help out if asked and do exactly what they would do if it was one of our networks. And so building that trust, working with people before there's a real problem, trying to make sure that everybody has access to the same grade of tools, even if we don't all choose the same vendor. And then the other thing we do is just outreach with the Oklahoma ISAC. We send out information as frequently as we can of new and emerging threats, things to be on the lookout for. We even send out IOCs so people can upload them directly to their firewalls if they don't have the kind of staff that the state has. We do all of those things. And just speaking for some of the great folks on the other side of the wall here, I can't tell you how many times my phone has started vibrating off my table at home, and it's people on my team calling local governmental entity folks that they know through communications channels and saying, hey, we just spotted this and we think it's hitting you. And that's helped to build that trust, and it brings more people together. And so over time, we just get stronger every day. But I cannot echo Mr. Sloan's initial point enough. Protecting my network means absolutely nothing if everybody else in the state burns. And so we are all interconnected. We're all in it together. If any one of us is hit, all of us are in danger.
Yeah. It made me think of something as both of you, JR and Michael, you were talking. There's obviously a lot of collaboration and, you know, bilateral sort of information exchange and community building within the state with this whole of state, you know, and local government approach. What about across states in terms of best practice sharing, especially at the executive level? Are there forums by which you learn from your peers and share best practices? Not necessarily in terms of, but where does a typical kind of forum or avenue for some of that sharing? Anyone?
So, I'll jump in on that. You know, we've been very fortunate in Arizona to have, I think, some very, broad-minded chief information security officers in recent years, and that have the mindset, right? So they've been plugged in with the multi-state ISAC and, you know, those types of forums, but also, sharing freely through other, national associations like NASIO, as well as other, information security-specific communities. One of the wonderful things that I see in state government, and it applies to cybersecurity, but I will say applies broadly to even digital services, is like, we're not in competition with one another necessarily. So we're happy to share anything that we have that's working. And so whether that's, processes, products that we've had success with, programs, all of that is really open to be shared, whether that's, within the state or across states. And so I found that, other states are definitely willing to share where they've had success. And frankly, through building relationships and trust, right, you can kind of get in the, the opportunity to share, hey, this is something that we had a challenge with. And has anyone addressed this in a way that could help us be more successful in the future?
Forums like this, where your willingness to come and share, right, take time out of your busy days to do this in a work day, it's highly commendable and appreciated. David, I have a question for you from our audience. You were going to say something, David?
Yes, I wanted to build on what JR said about NASIO, and there's also a directors association that gets together twice a year. The 8 years that I was with Wisconsin, I attended 16 of those sessions twice a year. Extremely valuable to share and somewhat commiserate, if you will, our challenges with cybersecurity. And also to echo what Michael said, we're all interconnected. And this whole estate strategy will work if everyone is participating on a need to protect bases. But you have to respect local government. For decades, they've been autonomous and they've been left alone. And they lack the trust of state and federal government. So we have to work at building relationships, as I was doing in Wisconsin. I became well known among the county directors. They understood where I was coming from. They were accessing 22 state systems, and I had no visibility as to the people that were in local government. I had the challenge of trying to understand the state employees, but now I've got to expand their radius out to the local government. So trust is a big part of whole of state. Mm-hmm. We understand and convey to them, as Michael just did, we're in this together. There are no boundaries respected by the hackers. Once somebody gets hit, whether it's a partner or whether it's next door, a state, the hack and the malware is traveling. But the speed of light and respecting no boundaries whatsoever. You were going to ask me a question, Kavita.
Yeah, no, I have a question from the audience, but thank you for sharing that. A question really is, during a serious incident like a ransomware attack, where do you see improvements can be made in how impacted agencies and jurisdictions would prepare, respond, and recover from future attacks?
Well, coincidentally, this morning, I got a call from a friend of mine up in northern Wisconsin, and a water facility has been attacked with ransomware. I immediately transferred them over to the cyber response teams in the state of Wisconsin that are housed in emergency management. And they were puzzled as to whether water was a critical infrastructure. It is. It is one of the 16. And in fact, it's one of the most vulnerable because it's usually operated by local government, not like a major corporation in the case of a power sectors or the energy sector. So it's sort of a double, if you will, a double vulnerability here that is being run with a low budget, without a CIO or CISO, and without any IT knowledge to be able to provide water to the local citizens. So I don't know what the outcome of that is yet, but we have resources that are standing up and ready to help that particular water facility. Now, there's 150,000 water facilities in this country. And many of them, the majority of them, if not 80 to 90% of them, are run by local government. So it's another reason for a whole of state to be embraced by local government, because some of them are operating critical infrastructure. So to get specific to your question, Make sure they know who to call in the state of Wisconsin and the cyber response teams. I'm not sure what the other states, you know, once the incident has been identified, you have to go ahead and staff the incident response team according to the software and the hardware that's configured at that particular facility, show up, resolve, and hopefully recover from that. Absolutely do not pay the ransom, as I think much of the legislation is headed in that direction. And hopefully one day we might be able to put these companies out of business.
Oh, thank you for that, David. JR and Michael, anything to add to that?
What I would add is really just to emphasize a point I think that David was making, which is, I'll say quick notification. The faster that we can get our SOC teams and I'll say the professionals involved, the better chance we have of a quick recovery. I understand that is now in its intention with if you have a cybersecurity insurance provider and, you know, their involvement and their, you know, I'll say objective to understand the scope and handle the liability of a potential incident. But I would err on the side of get your state resources, your local resources, get them engaged, get them involved, even if you're not sure of the scope yet. Like, don't wait until you're sure how bad it is. Reach out early, and better to get the team members involved and working with you along the way.
I think there's been a big cultural shift, right, both in enterprise and government, you know, off late, this notion of transparency when it comes to cyber incidents. It's not about, yes, assessing the full damage and then knowing how and when it is. Putting your arms around this and saying I have a responsibility to disclose when an incident has occurred. And there are regulations now that mandate that in a time-bound manner as well. But I think it's a big shift in the way, you know, how we assess risk and how we communicate risk and from a perspective of transparency. It's encouraged more so. Michael, anything to add to that?
No, not really, except maybe to say that in addition to notify early, you know, get the word out as early as you can, practice early. Obviously, in the moment that you're dealing with the threat, then practice is out the window. But before you have a threat, start bringing people together and talk about the what ifs. It might help. It might. I can't see that it wouldn't help. It might not be directly helpful or measurable at the moment. But if you can at least work out some of the jitters ahead of time, then you can be more effective earlier.
Right. I think, you know, red and blue teaming is an important part of, you know, incident response management. Right. As much as one can. I do have another question, actually quite interesting. Kind of, Michael, this one's for you. Do public agencies, specifically state and local government here, prioritize protecting infrastructure and services over sensitive data? So continuity of service versus protecting data that, you know, is obviously PII data and other critical citizen data,
government data. I personally don't see how you prioritize one over the other. Services and infrastructure, that's life safety in some cases. But sensitive data, my problem being passed on to a citizen in the form of their identity being stolen, and now they're having to clean up their credit report and everything else. Right. I don't see that you can prioritize one or the other. Unfortunately, with resources ever tighter, I don't see that you can put one over the top of the other. Lately, fortunately, and I agree with the point that was made earlier, one of our saving graces has been generally that the attacks come one at a time. And so in many cases, you don't have to make that choice. What does the future hold? I would not care to make a prediction because fate loves to prove me wrong.
Thank you, Michael. David, one more for you from the floor. Interesting, actually, these questions. What if cyber insurance takes the choice out of your hands to pay ransom? What's the position on that of this state?
Yeah, I saw that question and was puzzled by the fact that the insurance company would do that. I think we need the laws coming from the federal government that regardless of it's your desire or whether the insurance company is telling you to do that, it should not be permitted to pay the ransomware. we're not there yet, but that's my position is that I can't understand why the insurance company would do that, other than the fact that they've thrown their hands up and they've given up and they can't help. And that's the only way out is for them to pay the ransomware. But I would then look for a second insurance company that has the ability to service that. You know, that's not a good response. Sounds like somebody who's just given up on the issue.
Good answer, David. I mean, I think that whole cyber insurance discussion, we could have another session just to explore that in terms of, you know, residual risk and risk mitigation and how much are we spending on, you know, ensuring that we can cover liabilities through, you know, cyber insurance versus how much we're putting into investing in cyber defense and mitigation, right? It's a finite pool of money, finite pool of resources, working on audits versus, you know, shoring up the perimeter, right? But we will, you know, that's a whole different discussion. Maybe we'll have another session in the future, explore that. JR, I've got another question, actually just from my list. We, in our session earlier, we had talked about New York State starting a shared services program last year aimed at improving cybersecurity across the state that calls for state agencies to implement zero trust security and zero trust, you know, architecture specifically. Can you share with us, you know, explain a little bit, you know, why zero trust has become such an important part of cybersecurity strategy and, you know, embracing that framework across kind of state and local governments is becoming a standardized requirement?
Yeah, well, and I appreciate that you emphasized, you know, zero trust is a framework, not a product. I've had a number of, you know, providers come and try to sell me zero trust. You know, but why is zero trust, I think, why is it relevant? I think we absolutely saw not just, you know, I'll say momentum before the pandemic, but certainly as a result of the pandemic, the boundaries of our network and how we get our work done completely changed. And the advent of, you know, hybrid and remote work, the adoption of more and more cloud services, you know, we no longer operate sort of behind a moat, right? Where we could draw a moat around our, you know, our data centers and our users and say, well, if I just protect everything on the inside, I'm good. And the fact is that with you know, the new and emerging threats that compromise our users, anyone on the inside is, you know, it's fair game. So those are the reasons why. I mean, the fact is that you know, the nature of how we do our work, where our users are coming from, where our applications reside, how they interact with one another, all those boundaries have changed, and therefore we need better strategies for how we approach user authentication and authorization for accessing those applications.
Michael, David, anything to add to a comment on?
No, I think this is a very significant pivot in our cyber defense, and the sooner we embrace zero trust, the better off we'll be. It's just another shift in our defense that we have to acknowledge. We've been living in an implicit world for so long that now we need to double down and make sure that the right person, the right device, the right application has been authorized and they are able to do their job. Anything outside of those tunnels and outside of those lanes is not permissible. We just need to be able to make sure that we've secured every segment in that chain as best as possible.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. This is not an if to embrace. This is a win, and the win is now.
Agreed.
I'm glad to hear that. There's a momentum behind that. By the way, I think we've stirred up an entirely interesting debate or discussion around cyber insurance. We have a very spirited audience attending today. I'm just reading the comments as we're chatting here in terms of paying ransom. So Michael, Carlos, definitely reach out on LinkedIn. Let's have an interesting discussion around this. I'm keen to understand more. Interesting. So Michael has a question around how panelists define zero trust. From a, you know, perspective of tenants and framework. Michael, do you want to take that?
The way I look at it is we've all heard the old adage about trust but verify. Zero trust is one step beyond. Verify, then trust. don't assume because you have credentials that you have an authorized user. Don't assume that because the credentials were used 20 minutes ago, they're still valid now. We've all heard about it. You had people losing credentials, and so we came up with multi-factor authentication. Multi-factor authentication, then, well, the bad guys figured out how to steal tokens and whatever else, and they're right back in. And so zero trust is, again, it's not a product. You don't go out to the store and pick up a zero trust off the shelf. It's a framework. But the idea around zero trust is at any point when a user needs to access a thing, whether it be a system, data, what have you, verify that they are who they say they are and that the device and the path they're using is approved. If not, limit access until such time as they make the corrections needed to be back in line with the standards. That's how I look at it. That's kind of the methodology I've been following to this point, but love to hear other opinions too.
I mean, bringing into bear, like, obviously posture, identity, location, all of that, right? And rather than just the user specifically. So I think it's important application. Glad you touched upon that, and that it's an ecosystem, it's a framework. And so when people talk about, yeah, let's go pick up, you know, your zero trust solution from a store, right? It's really important to understand what the core architectural tenets are of said framework, and that the ecosystem is building towards that kind of evolving core set of tenets, right? Ask those architectural questions off the vendor community and the ecosystem that's servicing you, rather than leaning into an architecture where, you know, people are claiming zero trust architecture when it's not, in fact, the case. David, anything to add to that?
As I said earlier, it's the right person with the right credentials and the device that has been already acknowledged, the location and the application, from beginning to the end, that we are escorting them to do their job as authentically as we possibly can. We have lived in the implicit world too long, and we need to pivot to becoming very explicit in every segment of that chain.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. Thank you. Now I have one other question, somewhat asked by one of our attendees, but and I meant to kind of throw it out there. It's a lot of talk on AI. There's a lot of talk on, obviously, Gen AI and Gen AI generated threats, as well as internally you using AI across, you know, your solution base in terms of how you're leveraging AI to mitigate risk as well. So there's the threat hunting piece and there's the threat mitigation piece. Can I open it up to the floor in terms of your thoughts and what efforts are undergoing within the state and local government purview in this area? Any one of you?
I can start. I mean, there are products out there that have been doing this for a long time, and some of them are very, very good using a model-based AI approach to, if you see enough of these flags, do a thing. And then if you continue to see, do a bigger thing until, in its most extreme cases, you can lock down entire segments of the network if necessary. That has already existed, and I think a lot of us have implemented those in our various networks over time. One of the things I'm very interested in, and I'm watching closely, are the next gen SIM type tools, where instead of a tool that can do that to its narrow scope of things that it can see, building it in at the top level of across all of the tools, all of the systems, all of the servers. I'm watching that very closely. I'm very interested in that technology. And I think in not very long, you're going to see a lot of AI powered SIM solutions that do a lot of the things that we do now, you know, a person sitting behind a keyboard does automatically, at least enough to buy the people time to get involved and make sure that we're not alerting on false positives and what happens. So that's one of the trends that I've personally been watching closely, and I'm excited about.
Yeah, I think with the amount of data that we're sitting on too, right, really being able to kind of looking at all the new algorithms, machine learning algorithms that are coming out, being able to train these models as accurate to weed out a lot of the false positives. I think it's going to be very interesting. And then, as you said, Michael, automating across all of these, right? Automating whatever we've brought into the world of users, being able to automate that across the world of workloads and machines and creating sort of this harmonious environment. I think AI is going to play quite an interesting role in that. JR and David, anything to add? I had one other section I wanted to touch upon StateRAMP as well before we kind of conclude for today.
Briefly on this AI, there's not one customer that's got a lock on the intelligence of what the attack services of AI would be. I would ask that they consult with their vendors and their partners, where they're getting their services from. Their R&D is much deeper than any customer's organization. So be able to survey your existing architected customers, the partners, the vendors, and ask them, what are they doing about this AI threat? And they might be able to give you a segment of a view and a segment of their product, but you've got to talk to perhaps 5, 10, 15, 20 of those vendors and ask them, what are they doing about their particular product against the AI attacks that are coming their way?
Michael, or JR, anyone to add to that? And then we'll move to StateRAMP. Okay.
I don't have anything to add on top of what Michael and David have shared. I think they very insightful comments, and I think this way, I expect and I want to see within cybersecurity all of the benefits that are promises that we're seeing on the business side for generative AI and AI in general. I think we're acknowledging that, hey, AI has been around in our businesses for what, 20 years now. Right. The hype around generative AI is more recent, but the fact is that we've been using and leveraging the power of machines to help automate tasks and help us make decisions for some time. The size and the scale has grown significantly, and we have to adjust.
Yeah. No. Totally. StateRAMP. Let's talk a little bit about StateRAMP. And Frank, based on like so many of the things we've touched on today, before I move to StateRAMP, I think we talked a lot about problems and challenge and all of that. But what an exciting time to be in this space, right? To do what we do every day and to be able to kind of have that purview into what's coming on the horizon, what we're seeing. A super exciting time to be in IT and security and technology, right? I really hope that that message goes out to the folks who are looking to embark or embrace a career in IT, technology, and security that is really an exciting space to be in. Not just on the enterprise side, but really on the government side too. There's so many cool things to be working on. I really hope, through these sessions that we do, that not only are we solving or discussing these technology problems, but we're really piquing the interest of people considering careers in these areas as well. So, JR, my question to you, obviously, as the president of StateRAMP, share with us how StateRAMP helps improve the security of government at the state, kind of for scope and definition of.
Sure. Well, as we've talked this morning, a lot of cybersecurity efforts are around the things that we can touch, feel, hold, own, within the state. But what I want to recognize is that the value proposition of cloud-based offerings and cloud services and cloud-based applications are so compelling that we, as stewards of tax dollars, cannot ignore them. Yeah. They bring great value, and there are good solutions for us to adopt to provide digital services in the state. So, as we engage with these partners, how do we do that in a way that brings the same level of rigor and trust and assurance of protection of the data to those engagements? And that's really the problem that the StateRAMP seeks to solve. Working this problem since going back to 2015, 2016 here in Arizona, we had to stand up our own program where we were assessing vendors. And I saw the time, effort, and expense that it took to do that, and then recognized that I have at least 50 peers that are trying to solve the same problem. And then we have all of the, counties and cities and municipalities that all have the same problem. And FedRAMP isn't a one, is not the answer to everything. There's a number of solutions that we leverage at the state level that FedRAMP provides good coverage over. But the fact is, there's a lot of vendors and partners that we engage with that will never be part of FedRAMP because they just don't do business with the federal government. But they provide good value and good solutions to us at the state and local level. So we needed something that would bring the same value and the same proposition of assurance of security to the state level. And that's really what the vision of StateRAMP is to be.
Awesome. Thank you. So, Michael, obviously a state of Oklahoma, a member of StateRAMP. Now we're going to put JR on the spot. Michael, what hurdles are you facing and you're, to kind of navigate becoming a member and the benefits? And if there are any issues, JR is going to help now, obviously, with that.
I'm gonna take it easy on JR because the membership of FedRAMP, the joining, all happened before my time, so I can't speak directly to it. But I can tell you that all of the challenges JR listed, he's exactly right. There's 49 other states and countless other local entities trying to do the exact same things. And so what we have found using StateRAMP is that, and we did the whole trust but verify thing. We ran our own process side by side with you. In the early days, we don't do that anymore. So when a third party wants to come and do business with us and they say, we're StateRAMP, okay, that takes out a 15-page Excel spreadsheet matrix of questions and answers and 3 weeks of chasing cats and trying to get everyone lined up. And okay, yes, we can green light this one, go ahead and buy their product, or no, we can't for whatever reason. As far as I'm concerned, StateRAMP is accomplishing that mission. They are providing that service, and they are providing a means by, if I take off my CISO hat and I'm a vendor now trying to sell to CISOs, and I can say, hey, I've already gone through this rigorous assessment with StateRAMP. I have confidence that if my competitors can't say that, I'm already one step further ahead of them in the process than I would have otherwise been. So. We have been very happy with the process. We've been very happy with the experience. So I can't help you pick on JR today. Maybe
JR, he's a happy customer, so I think you're good there.
Did we lose Kavita?
It does appear that we did.
I am here in the office. I'm back.
Okay.
All right. So David, back. No.
Okay.
You in terms of Zscaler status, being part of StateRAMP and that whole certification process, you are, guided us through it. What does this mean?
So let me go a little bit higher on the altitude here. I think we all know that NISC Cybersecurity Framework 2.0 just came out. They added another word called govern, and I think this is headed towards StateRAMP. We're looking at a better way of governing the five steps that NIST had already laid out. And we've been doing that for 10 years. So I think we need to understand that. And to bring this back to the whole of state government, in Wisconsin, there's such a diversity of products in architecture practiced by the counties and the cities and the villages within Wisconsin. That dilution makes it very difficult to staff an incident response team, because we have to understand what products that entity is using, and then we have to find the skill sets on the incident response team. So another argument is to narrow the architecture and to be able to govern appropriately with the NISC framework of the five steps that we talked about earlier. So I'm looking at Zscaler being one of the early adopters of this understanding and making sure that we are participating and that we're actively involved in this in StateRAMP's mission. StateRAMP will get stronger and stronger and stronger as each member joins. To the extent that they get the majority of states, they'll have a larger voice in defining architecture that is compliant. There's another thing going on, the SEC attack on SolarWinds, another set of regulations that are gonna come out, comparable to Sarbanes-Oxley years ago, 2008, 2009. The SOX compliance issue is also having an effect in the financial community. Mm-hmm. Shortly, maybe this year, maybe next year, the SEC is going to get very explicit with publicly traded companies. This is what you should be doing. And there's going to be some understanding of architecture woven through that. And certainly at the top of that would be a zero trust approach, making sure that organizations have adopted this explicit notion of everybody participating in that channel of processing. So if we can look at StateRAMP being a governing body for us, for a state, it's somewhat voluntary today, but it has a tremendous amount of value. And I'm happy that Zscaler is a part of that and has been involved very early on.
Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for your time this morning, this afternoon for some of you. That's about all the time we have today on this Executive Connect Live.
Thanks for listening to the CIO Evolution. Check back with your podcast provider regularly for more episodes. You can find more episodes along with other podcasts on the CXO Revolutionaries website at revolutionaries.zscaler.com. Statements by Zscaler podcasters and guests are informational only and should never be construed as legal advice. You should consult your legal advisor on matters related to you or your business. Zscaler makes no warranties, express, implied, or statutory as to the content of this podcast, and it is provided as is. Content on this podcast may contain forward-looking statements that are current as of the date of the recording and subject to change. These statements are subject to the safe harbor provisions created by the Private Securities Litigation Reform Act of 1995. Full legal disclaimers are available at revolutionaries.zscaler.com. Copyright 2021.